Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On the Money is recorded live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program this week...
For me personally, financial freedom meant living a safe life away from violence.
We know women are behind when it comes to superannuation, wages and security, and we speak with the co-founder of new startup Money Girl, a social enterprise helping young women attain financial literacy. Also on the program...
You know, there is already an audience that have watched Bond, and it goes through generations. So there's that whole generational thing as well that... I can sit with my young son, you know, and potentially watch a Bond film, or there might be a Bond cartoon that comes out that's targeted at that younger demographic.
Looks like 007 is facing his greatest challenge, being acquired by corporate overlords for his massive box office earning potential. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Money. First, emissions are down thanks to COVID-induced recession, but there is still growing concern that Australia will struggle to meet its net zero target emissions. There is some hope, though. Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute believes that Australia could become a global hydrogen exporter. And Sophia Turek asked him how important hydrogen is for Australia's economy.
In some sectors of the economy, if we're going to decarbonise in the timeframes we're talking about, hydrogen seems to be almost the only technical solution that we can identify. So for those sectors, hydrogen will be very important. There are other areas where people have talked about hydrogen as having a role where I think that there are other alternatives which are more likely to be much cheaper and easier to do. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag in a sense, but I certainly think that there are potentially some really interesting challenges that could be addressed with hydrogen. And the two obvious ones would be some major industries where decarbonising otherwise is very difficult, and the other one is whether or not we can take advantage of Australia's comparative advantage in renewable energy and use green hydrogen as a source of greater economic activity to replace fossil fuels.
So currently the government's investing more in, you know, what you'd call blue hydrogen. How hard would it be to transition our current investment into blue hydrogen to green hydrogen?
Oh, we've so far done very little investment in blue hydrogen. The idea, of course, is that, you know, you make the hydrogen from natural gas, and the reason you do that in the short term because it's a lot cheaper than making it from renewable energy, partly because the technologies to make it from renewable energy, in particular the electrolyzers which convert water to hydrogen and oxygen, are still very expensive. Now, just about everybody in the industry is very confident that those costs will come down significantly, but there's some way to go. So in the meantime, a much more cost-effective way is to produce the blue hydrogen. Now, you have to be a little bit careful here because if you produce the hydrogen from natural gas, which is the way hydrogen is produced today inside the factories that make explosives and fertilisers in Australia and other places and petrochemicals, hydrogen is used in a manufacturing process, but it never gets out. It's basically natural gas is made into hydrogen, and the hydrogen is then made into something else, so you never see it. Now, if you manufacture the hydrogen from natural gas, then you produce hydrogen, certainly, but the carbon content of the natural gas or the methane ends up usually as CO2, and the greenhouse gas go with that. So if you then do something with that carbon dioxide, that is sequester it, bury it, deep underground, that produces, you've then got what's called blue hydrogen, because even though it's very, very low emissions, possibly close to zero, it's not produced from green sources such as, you know, wind or solar. So that's where the definition is. Now, as far as I'm aware, we've not yet got to the point of doing both steps, that is producing hydrogen from natural gas in a independent production process and then sequestering that CO2 to make it into what's called blue hydrogen. Because if you simply do the alternative, which is to vent the CO2 to the atmosphere, obviously that's not helping the greenhouse gas emissions at all. In fact, it's adding to them, if anything.
So just in terms of the budget, the government announced these, like, clean hydrogen exports. How effective do you think they will be?
Look, I think potentially the opportunity for Australia from exports based on hydrogen is quite dramatic. And there are several reasons why this is interesting. And we wrote a major report about this about just over a year ago now. And the reason is why it's important and interesting is twofold. On the one hand, if the world does seriously do what it's proposing to do and moves away from fossil fuels, and many countries in the world who buy our coal and gas today have made commitments to reduce their own emissions by 2050. Some of them net zero by 2050. Some China, for example, net zero by 2060. So obviously that would mean a very large source of export revenue for Australia will gradually disappear. Now, I'm not having an emotional discussion around that. It's basically a technical political debate. So the first thing is that what do we do about that in terms of replacing those exports? The second thing is that those industries employ a lot of people in certain parts of the country in what we call carbon-intensive jobs, coal mining and so forth. And it'll be, from a political perspective, replacing those jobs, particularly in places like Central Queensland and in the Hunter and Illawarra region of New South Wales, would be very important. And thirdly, is to think about, we've got huge amounts of space in Australia. We've got a very valuable or potentially valuable resource in our wind and solar energy. We could do what we've always done with coal and gas. We could just export the energy. And that's what the project that Mike Cannon Brooks is involved with is looking to do. They want to build a power cable to Singapore and export electricity.
And just finally on hydro. There's been, a lot of controversy around smart hydro. Can make that scheme better and more viable and other pumped hydro schemes?
The government, because it owns Snowy Hydro now, and I think partly the decision to buy out for the federal government to buy out the other two state shareholders, namely New South Wales and Victorian government, was because they could then basically get control of Snowy Hydro and decide what to do with it and announce the Snowy Hydro 2.0 pumped hydro storage facility. Now, the trick with this is going to be, how effective is pumped hydro going to be in terms of being able... The reason you have it, of course, is to be able to balance wind and solar when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. That may very well have a role. And it will have a potentially different role from batteries. Now, the challenges are that in some cases it's quite expensive, and a lot of outside the Snowy Hydro scheme, which is very large, huge, effectively, pumped hydro project, there are lots of other opportunities, most of them are relatively small because we don't have big mountains where we can do a lot of pumped hydro. There is a project in North Queensland which looks like it's going to get off the ground, but that's just about it, really. There's not many projects that at the moment are being seriously thought about. The other possibility is pumped hydro in Tasmania, which is also a major source of hydro energy, but that requires a new connection to the mainland as well. So I think the main thing about pumped hydro is it still seems relatively expensive, and that's just a physical situation because, unless you've got pre-existing facilities like Snowy Hydro itself or like the dams that exist in North Queensland around an old mine, they were the tailing dams, and those dams are now being used for the pumped hydro project. It turns out pumped hydro can be pretty expensive, and so it's quite possible that it will struggle to compete with batteries, and the cost of batteries is coming down dramatically.
Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute speaking there with Sophia Turek. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network.
You're listening to On the Money, where smart money listens right around Australia.
Over 70% of women worldwide lack financial literacy, leaving them without control over their own finances. This shocking statistic is part of why Mariam Mohammed co-founded MoneyGirl, a social enterprise designed to make financial education more fun and accessible for young Australian women. Aisha Janif spoke with Mariam and asked her what inspired her to start this company.
Melissa and I both graduated university at the same time, and we started thinking about our own journey towards financial freedom. For me personally, financial freedom meant living a safe life away from violence as well. I came to Australia to escape gendered violence in Pakistan, but I found financial independence meant that I was safe in the now. My future was always very uncertain. I was always walking a very thin line between going back to that life of violence. And so I started thinking about what does financial security for women in the long term mean. And as Melissa and I embarked on this journey, we found a real dearth of knowledge. We thought, why don't we put it together in a format that is also easily accessible for other people just like us who are also on this journey? And it's not just accessible, it is also fun and engaging, because so that's where MoneyGirl came about from. Really, it was to address our own need for financial literacy.
And why is financial literacy such a pressing issue? You've touched upon it with its links to domestic violence, but could you elaborate?
An average Australian woman who, let's say, goes to university and graduates, when she enters the workforce, she might be getting paid similar to her male counterparts, but as years progress, her gender pay gap will remain at about 14%, okay? And then in her 30s and 40s, most likely she will take time out for care responsibilities. And that might not just be children, it might be parents of herself, her partners, et cetera. These responsibilities still fall primarily on women in Australia. By the time she returns to the workforce, she will have given up, one, super all those years, two, pay rises and promotions. So by the time she is coming back, that 14% pay gap is now significantly more. So by the time she retires, she will have about 47% less in her superannuation than her male counterparts. Meanwhile, women in Australia still live on average about 5 years longer than men. So what then happens is over 55, she then experiences a higher chance of becoming homeless and destitute. So you see, the impact of financial illiteracy is not just money mismanagement in the now and today. It has a long-term compounding impact on the overall well-being and safety of a woman. A woman particularly, although everybody experiences the problem of financial illiteracy, you see some of these things have a more gendered impact. MoneyGirl's goal is to empower every young woman with the right education and skills so she is able to make sound financial decisions for their future.
Describe your experience in managing your own startup and its business model.
MoneyGirl is a for-profit social enterprise. What that means is we do charge for our services and we do make money, so we're not a charity or a nonprofit. What we do, however, is we have a cross-subsidization model whereby our B2B customers subsidize the cost for our B2C customers, in very simple terms, that when young women as individuals come to us and need financial education but might not necessarily be able to access it, we are able to give them partial or full scholarships funded by our own profits and sometimes by partnerships. That is how MoneyGirl works to make financial literacy more accessible. How we were able to do it, it was, I would say, definitely a challenge as young women and young women of color to get people to take the idea of an alternative business model more seriously, because there is a very westernized idea of what a business can look like or what a solution to a problem can and should look like.
Having MoneyGirl be a out-of-box solution, how did you go about developing the course itself?
Where we designed the solution was an intersection of grassroots community knowledge, subject matter expert knowledge, and academic knowledge. In Australia, it's the only evidence-based financial education course that exists.
What did you learn in your past roles that you transfer to MoneyGo?
So I had experience working in the nonprofit sector, primarily with refugees, and also at the University of Sydney. I had worked primarily with women because I was the women's officer there, and later I was the president of their student union. My experience was working with an intersection of youth, primarily women and women of color. I had seen a lot of these experiences play out in real life, not just in my life, because I was this young person experiencing all these problems as well, but also in my peers, you know. So I had this validation that my experience is in no way unique, unfortunately. Women everywhere, every day, are experiencing violence because of various different reasons, one of them being financial control.
Now, Mariam, looking towards the future, what would you keep, change, and create to increase financial literacy for future generations?
I would keep an evidence-based financial education course. The reason for that is there's heaps of Band-Aid solutions out there, but that is not what we need. Band-Aid solutions have existed for decades, and so has the problem. They don't work. What I would change is financial literacy being made accessible to people at a very young age, in like whether that is the formal education system or informal education system, but age-appropriate financial education all the way from childhood to retirement. Create a model of financial education that can be adapted and implemented across the world. Just fix the problem.
Mariam Mohammed, co-founder of MoneyGirl, speaking there with Aisha Janif.
If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
The fragmentation of the streaming industry continues as Amazon today announced that it would purchase Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. One of the world's oldest film studios, Amazon intends to use its intellectual property to build the film production as the fourth pillar of the company alongside its marketplace, cloud storage and streaming service Prime. Amazon is using its deep pockets to stake its claim against competitors like Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus. But will it be successful? Tony Hebbings has this story.
The name's Bezos, Jeff Bezos. That's how the Amazon founder could have begun the company's annual shareholder meeting on Wednesday, where he announced that Amazon would be purchasing the legendary US film studio Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. While some may say Mr. Bezos has more in common with a Bond supervillain, it's indisputable that Amazon Prime will be the home of past and future Bond movies as the new owners of that intellectual property. Other notable films and television shows that now call Amazon home include the Rocky franchise, The Handmaid's Tale, and The Wizard of Oz.
There's no place like home. There's no place like...
Earlier, I sat down with Mark C. Scott, senior lecturer in screen and media at Victoria University, and asked him to explain the broad strokes of this blockbuster deal.
The purchase was an $8.5 billion purchase. Now, this is not the largest that Amazon has done previously. It purchased Whole Foods for $13.4 billion in 2017. You know, it's used to acquiring companies of such a level. So I think, you know, with Amazon purchasing MGM, they've now got an amazing back catalogue, which MGM had. And along with that, there's a lot in terms of IP. So MGM has access to the Bond franchise, Rocky, Tomb Raider, some of those films and those franchises that many Australians would be aware of. So it's now a case of seeing what Amazon will do with those. And we've seen with, you know, the Marvel franchise, how that's been able to be expanded through streaming services.
Is it the sort of thing where that is the real draw point for a company like Amazon, you know, who has a bit of history commissioning films to try and get awards buzz? Their most notable kind of recent commission was Coming to America, the sequel with Eddie Murphy. The real appeal regarding gathering all of this existing intellectual property?
So I think the biggest problem with streamers is the fact that, you know, when we're watching content, we're just constantly, you know, going through that content and very quickly then saying, okay, we've watched that, what have you got next? Amazon probably doesn't have the deep catalogue that now, you know, other streaming services like Netflix and more so Disney have. So by purchasing something like MGM, they now have that deep catalogue where they can use that archival content to bolster up the catalogue that they already have. But also they can push on that, as I'd mentioned, around, you know, building the Bond universe, building out Rocky further or Tomb Raider or whatever other IP that they may have gained from the purchase of MGM. The other key difference, I think, here is that Amazon is known for selling things. They can start to sell to customers. They're getting access to data where, you know, if I'm watching Rocky, then they know that I've watched that program. I might then be shown, you know, some boxing gloves or do you want to get fit or whatever it may be. It allows them to then connect this into the other area that they're known for, which is shopping online.
Do you think, in terms of the price, you know, the amount is, you know, one of these, it's a bit of a headline grabber. And yet, you know, when we think about how much, say, Disney paid for all the 20th Century Fox studios and then comparatively even back to Lucasfilm, do you think it's the sort of thing where from what we've seen with those companies, it's an investment that makes its own back and then some pretty quickly?
Yeah, I think this is a purchase that's not purely just about MGM and the back catalogue. As I mentioned, I think the IP is the other thing that comes along with that, and the doors that that opens, not only for the future content, the original content that now Amazon can make, but also the additional data that they're now getting from their users and how they can now sell products to them. So as part of Amazon Prime, there's an X-ray feature, which if you click on when you're watching a program, it'll give you, you know, features like the actors, it'll link into behind the scenes, it'll give you trailers. The addition now is it could potentially give you products based on what you're watching at that particular time.
I mean, the Bond universe has always been one where the product marketing has played a big part. You know, we know that James Bond wears Rolexes or Omega watches, drives an Aston Martin or a BMW. Is that the sort of thing then that you think comes into play? You know, the availability of this type of purchasing what James Bond has?
Yeah, I'm not sure how many people will purchase a Rolex off Amazon, but I think there's also the option of, well, if you're into the Bond universe, then, you know, there's so much merchandise that comes from those. And so Amazon having exclusive access to that particular merchandise, then, you know, they're gaining not only from you watching the Bond, but also purchasing the merchandise and engaging. And it's really around data analytics as well, the data they're able to capture from you watching that content. And then going away and doing the shopping.
As a streaming provider, though, in terms of the competition, Amazon, is this one of the moves that Amazon's making to try and really shore up their place with Disney Plus, with Netflix? Does this cement Amazon Prime's place as trying to compete for our attention?
Yeah, I think most people would see Netflix as the leader pretty much in most countries, if not all of them. In an Australian context, there's Netflix, but then there's also Foxtel, then there's Stan, and then at the end of that is Amazon Prime. Disney is very quickly catching up, but it's sitting at the moment in the Australian context, it's sitting behind Amazon Prime. Between 2019 and 2020, Amazon in Australia almost tripled the number of subscribers that it had. So we're definitely seeing Australians being more aware of Amazon, but it's also the question of how many streaming services is enough or too many.
Do you think, given that a lot has been made of the IP element of this, and just thinking, you know, a lot of one of Amazon's big name investments in the streaming arena is their Lord of the Rings television show, which at most recent estimate, I believe, was going to cost $450 million. We've also just had, in similar sense, we've just had like a Friends reunion much discussed. Is this the sort of thing where we're starting to see that the real currency in these streaming economies is less original IP, but is more the nostalgia for existing IP and looking at new ways of revisiting it?
I think that's part of what we're seeing more recently, and you mentioned Friends, but I think part of this is also, you know, revisiting that, building on it and building to the cult audience that's already there. You know, there is already an audience that have watched Bond, and it goes through generations. So there's that whole generational thing as well, that I can sit with my young son, you know, and potentially watch a Bond film, or there might be a Bond cartoon that comes out that's targeted at that younger demographic that's only available on Amazon Prime. So IP is a really critical thing because it allows them to create further content that also allows the audience to then engage with that older content, that older IP that's sitting there.
Mark C. Scott, Senior Lecturer at Victoria University, speaking there with Toby Hemmings. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On The Money, around Australia on the Community Radio Network. And that's all we've got for you on The Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers Toby Hemmings, Talia Kreft, Aisha Janif, Sufia Tariq and Andrew Herlinger. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2ECR for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ecr.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. So do stay well and thanks for your company.
Especially today.